no room was available for early check-in, they were to pass the time in the lobby or restaurant until contacted. This courtyard by Marriott stood near the airport, a nice, small-scale, four-story hotel, and there was a room available for early check-in, and the front desk took cash instead of a credit card. Daddy had said Mother needed to abandon Aunt Tandy's Dodge, which was a relief to Jolie, because she was steeped to the bone in the lingering scent of Uncle Calvin's verbena cologne and the smell of musty car carpet. A bellman brought their bags to the room, and he was cute enough to stir her imagination into concocting a future that didn't involve traveling forever in fits and starts according to Daddy's directions. But shortly after he left, her presentiment of sliding into some terrible danger was fulfilled, big time. Twyla declared that she needed to use the bathroom, and she started to go in there with her purse, so Jolie said, "Why don't you leave your phone here?" Twyla said, "My phone?" "Yes, your phone. You shouldn't call Charles to tell him where we are. He doesn't need to know. And anyway, we're not supposed to be dropping breadcrumbs like Hansel and Gretel." Twyla stared at Jolie as if Jolie had gone mad. "Breadcrumbs? You know what I mean." She turned to her mother. "Mom, Twyla has some Svengali in her life named Charles, a truly devious man, and it's possible he's hooked her on drugs." Such a look of perplexity and anxiety settled on Mother that Jolie half wished she'd never started this, burdening her mother with yet another worry. But there was no going back. "Jolie," Mother said, "whatever's gotten into you? Svengali? Drugs? If there's one girl in this world who's got her act together even more than you, it's your sister." "Oh, Mom, I wish that were true. I really, really do." Jolie picked up Twyla's suitcase and put it on the bed, and Twyla told her not to open it, but Jolie unlatched the bag anyway and threw it open with dramatic flair. "Hypodermic syringes, Mother." Except there were no syringes, and no insulated metal box where those things had been before. Jolie opened the divider and revealed the other half of the suitcase, which appeared to contain no incriminating evidence. Twyla looked at Jolie as if hurt and mystified, which was too deceitful. It really was. Rooting determinedly through her sister's clothes, searching for the needles and the insulated box of drugs chilled in dry ice, certain they had been repositioned, Jolie said, "Twy was sitting up in the armchair last night, sitting in the dark, watching me while I slept." "I know you were, Twy. And now I know it was because you realized I'd found the drugs." As if bewildered, playing it as well as if she were an actress instead of a visual artist, Twyla said, "Mother, what's wrong with her? Why is she doing this?" Switching to the first side of the suitcase and pawing through those clothes as well, Jolie said, "I'm doing it because it's true." "Where did you hide them, Twy? Open your purse. It's a large purse. Let's see what's in the purse." Mother said, "Jolie, you're overwrought. Sit down, honey, and calm yourself." "I'm not overwrought, Mom. I don't get overwrought. I've never been overwrought in my life." Twyla stepped to the bed and turned her purse upside down. She had zipped open its various compartments. The contents tumbled onto the bedspread. "Look, Joe. You see? No syringes, no drugs, unless you count Visine as a drug." She held out the purse. "Here, go ahead. Take it. Make sure there's nothing in it." "You knew I'd found them," Jolie said. "So you ditched them back in Lake Forest." "Twy, I love you. I'm only trying to help." "I believe you are, sweetheart. I believe you're trying to help me, but I don't need help, and I don't understand where all this is coming from." "You sat up last night watching me sleep. Why were you watching me sleep? Because you knew I'd found the drugs, the needles." "I didn't sit up watching you, Joe. I slept like a stone." Jolie wanted to puke. She was shocked that Twyla could lie so boldly and, it seemed, so effectively. Like a stone, huh? Yeah, like the Blarney Stone. All this lying makes me want to spew. You're making me sick, Twy. What you're doing here, it makes me sick. Mother had gotten a Coca-Cola from the honor bar and poured it in a glass. Here, Jolie, sit down. Calm yourself. She guided Jolie to an armchair. Drink this, baby. Drink it and settle your nerves. Jolie took the glass and frowned at it and said, Who drinks Coke to settle their nerves? You just said you wanted to throw up, Mother reminded her. Everyone knows that Coca-Cola can settle a bad tummy. Take a deep breath, Twyla said. Drink your Coke. And then we'll talk about this, Joe. I'll answer all your questions. This is just some ridiculous misunderstanding. Jolie suddenly heard herself anxiety breathing. She had been taking rapid, shallow breaths, hyperventilating like a frightened child, and she hadn't realized the image of distress she projected. She actually wasn't afraid, only worried about Twyla and frustrated that Twy had been aware of her suspicion and had taken steps to hide or destroy the evidence. But addicts were world-class deceivers, both of other people and of themselves. Everybody knew that. Trying to be calm and sound reasonable, Jolie was still too shrill when she said, Make Twyla show you her arms, Mom. You'll see needle tracks on one or both arms. Make her show you. Make her. Jolie, you're scaring me now, Mother said. This isn't like you, saying such horrible, crazy things about your sister. Twyla said, It's okay, Mother. Look at this. She pulled up the right sleeve of her blouse, well past the crook of the elbow. The skin was smooth. No puncture marks from self-injections. Look here. She pulled up the left sleeve. Flawless skin. It's all just some silly misunderstanding. Calm down, Joe. Drink your Coke, and we'll talk. We'll work this out. Mother sat on the arm of the chair, smoothing Jolie's hair with one hand. Please, honey, let's all be adults here. Drink the Coca-Cola and calm down, and we'll sort this out. Jolie had been urged once too often to drink the Coca-Cola. Maybe twice too often. In an instant, she was calm, totally composed, self-possessed in the manner of a condemned man with a noose around his neck and a trap door under his feet and mere seconds in which to think of a way to slip out of the hangman's rope. Mother sat on the arm of the chair, one hand now on Jolie's shoulder. Twyla stood in front of the chair, loomed in front of the chair. Twyla was staring at the glass of fizzing cola. Mother also stared at the glass of cola, as if the glass were the grail and the Coke was the wine that would be changed into blood. Jolie said, Oh, shit. Mother looked up from the cola. Twyla looked up from the cola. Jolie bolted from the chair, threw the Coke in her sister's face. Chapter 11. As prearranged, Jane followed Bernie Rigowitz to the outskirts of Tucson, less than an hour from Enrique DeSoto's unconventional car dealership, where they parked side by side in a supermarket lot. They transferred Jane's suitcases and tote bag from the Mercedes to the Ford Explorer. Better take off the hat, she said, or some cop might arrest you for being a mob boss.
Who knew I could look like a stone-cold killer? Enough with this retirement business. I got a career as a character actor.
You're a character, that's for sure. They hugged each other, and she kissed him on the cheek. And he said she should wait. There was something he wanted to give her. He gave her his iPhone number, his address in Brooklyn, the address of his daughter in Scottsdale, his daughter's phone number, the name and number of his nephew, a periodontist, in case she ever needed a tooth implant, a card from a bakery in Scottsdale where their challah was to die for, and one of the photographs of Miriam, that he carried in his wallet as he traveled the country with her spirit. After another hug, she got in the Explorer and closed the door, and Bernie leaned in the open window.
"Make like you really are my granddaughter, Alice, and tell me true. Are you going to be okay?"
"I have a chance, Bernie. What do any of us have but a chance?"
"Whatever you've mixed yourself in, I hope you mix yourself out. By me, you deserve more than a chance. You deserve the best."
She hesitated and said, "Do you really not know who I am?"
"Should I maybe watch the news? Read the news? Pfft. It's all lies, or depressing lies. I don't need to know who you are, to know who you are."
Chapter 12. Threw the coke in Twyla's face and barreled into her and knocked her backward onto the hotel room bed. Mother came off the arm of the chair. "Jolie, stop this," and grabbed her. Jolie tore free and went for the door. A deadbolt, a security chain. Mother clutched Jolie's hand and tried to prevent her from disengaging the chain. "We only want the best for you, honey. It's for the best. It really is." Never had Jolie raised a hand against her mother. Until now, she never imagined a situation in which either might assault the other. She found herself left defenseless by love, unable to strike a blow. Mother turned Jolie away from the door, pressed her back to it, and pinned her there. No anger in Mother's face, only what seemed to be concern. "Honey, it's okay. You don't understand, but it's going to be okay. Would I ever do anything to hurt you, sweetie? Of course I wouldn't. I brought you into the world, and I want only good things for you. Only the very best." Their faces were inches apart, breath mingling with breath. Jolie searched her mother's eyes. She could see nothing different about those eyes, no menace in them. "I just want to go for a walk," Jolie said, dismayed to hear a tremor in her voice. This was her mother, but Jolie sensed that it was dangerous to convey weakness. "I just need some fresh air. Clear my head." "We have to stay here, honey, in case Daddy's friends contact us. Anyway, I can't let you go for a walk alone, a pretty young girl in a strange city." Twyla had wiped the cola out of her eyes. She lifted Mother's suitcase onto the bed. "Listen to Mom, Joe. I don't know why you've taken such a turn against me, but you know Mom is on your side." "Jolie, dear, you're shaking like a leaf," Mother said. "What in the world is going through that crazy imagination of yours? Let's go back to the chair and you sit down and I'll get you another Coca-Cola." Opening the suitcase, Twyla said, "You should have drunk your cola last night at McDonald's, the one I ordered with your dessert." Still pressing Jolie against the door, Mother smiled and said, "It was just too much sweet, cola with a dessert. That's what you said. And you were right, of course." So there must have been a sedative in the cola. "When you and Mother came back from the bathroom," Twyla said, "she drank her coffee. She drank it all. And if you had just drunk your cola, you wouldn't be so agitated now." Her mother smiled. Her breath was warm and pleasant smelling. It reminded Jolie of the aroma of fresh baked bread. Mother's voice was soft and reassuring. "Twyla's right, dear. You wouldn't now be so agitated. You see, I'm not. This is all unnecessary, sweetheart. Let's go back to the chair and sit down and be respectful to one another." From Mother's suitcase, Twyla extracted the hypodermic syringes and the insulated metal box. She put them on the bedspread. "What's going to happen to me?" Jolie asked. happened to you? Mother said, and laughed softly, with apparent affection, as if her younger daughter's failure to understand was adorable. Nothing's going to happen to you, honey. I love your sense of drama. You're probably going to be a great writer someday. A really great writer. What are those needles about? You get a flu vaccine every year, don't you? This isn't about the flu. It's not that time of year. Anyway, doctors give flu shots. Mother's voice was soothing and so reasonable. Oh, not only doctors, Jolie. Nurses give them. Sometimes pharmacists give them. People with the littlest bit of training give them at warehouse stores, places like that. You've even had a flu shot at a warehouse store, honey, and you said it was the most painless ever. Do you remember? Of course you do. And you're right, sweetie. This isn't about the flu. It's much more important than a silly little flu shot. The more Mother talked, the less she seemed like Mother. There was a word for the way she sounded now. Oleaginous. Oily. She was trying too hard to comfort Jolie, layering on the reassurance too thickly. I feel dizzy, Jolie said. She had been standing stiffly, her shoulders tensed, as her mother pressed them against the door. She sagged, suddenly weak. I need to sit down. We all need to sit down, honey. Sit down together and figure this out. Twyla was getting another Coca-Cola from the honor bar. Okay, Jolie said shakily. Let's sit down, and you tell me what this is all about. Mother let go of Jolie, but still held her against the door with her body. She smiled. That's more like my Jolie. As she searched her daughter's eyes, she put one hand to Jolie's face and stroked her cheek with apparent affection, whether genuine or not. Jolie hated what she did, but she did it anyway. Bit the hand. She bit it hard and tasted blood, and her mother cried out in shock and pain. Mother stepped back, and Jolie punched her in the stomach, and Mother dropped to her knees beside the bed. Mother's purse stood on the nearby nightstand. Jolie grabbed it, pivoted to the door, disengaged the security chain, threw open the door, slammed it behind her, and ran. Their room was on the third floor, stairs at both ends of the corridor, no time for the elevator. As Jolie opened the stairwell door, she heard running footsteps behind her. She glanced back. Twyla. She raced down the stairs, which seemed to telescope out before her, adding a tread for every tread she descended, so that she might never get to the bottom. Jolie was in a state. She had never been in such a state before, torn by so many emotions, terrified, but at the same time crying in grief for having somehow lost her mother and sister. How? Why? To what? Burning with shame for hurting her mother, yet fiercely pleased with herself for having gotten away. The world had been wobbly to one degree or another ever since Cora Gunderson killed herself and those people at the hotel. But during the past 3 days it had grown more wobbly ever faster, and now it had abruptly undergone a total pole shift, north becoming south, the new angle of rotation, apocalyptic. Jolie could feel the outer crust of the earth sliding catastrophically to a new position under her feet, entire continents heaving and colliding and buckling over one another, all the works of humanity crashing down in ruins, and mile-high tsunamis coming fast out of the deep sea, metaphorically, if not literally. Feet pounding, heart pounding, she ran to the ground floor and opened the fire door and hurried along a corridor. As she sprinted toward the lobby, she zippered open her mother's purse and took from it the disposable phone. Close behind her, she heard her sister call her name, and as they dashed into the lobby, Twyla shouted, "Help me! Somebody help me! Stop my sister! She's hallucinating! She's taken drugs!" Jolie stopped and turned and threw Mother's purse, and it hit Twyla square in the face. Twyla stumbled, and maybe she fell, but Jolie didn't wait to see. She ran toward the front entrance, and when people moved as if to intercept her, she screamed at them to fuck off, screamed so hard that spittle flew. She had never used that word before, but she used it now, snarled it, as if she really might be a crazy person on drugs, because nothing mattered except escaping. Realizing there was blood on her chin, her mother's blood, she shouted, "I'll bite you!" when the F word didn't work. Through the front entrance, into the cool day, she ran, flat out, her heart knocking so hard that with every beat she felt shaken, as if quakes were rocking her flesh and bones along fault lines in her body, breath burning her throat. When she finally dared to look back, no one pursued her, but still, she ran. Chapter 13. Jane couldn't do anything more just yet. She would go after DJ Michael where he really was, which would no doubt be on the 9th floor of his building in San Francisco. But not today. Not tomorrow. Too little sleep, too much stress, and too much emotion expended had left her shaky, strained muscles, grainy eyes, fuzzy thinking. She got a motel room in Tucson and took the longest shower of her life, letting the hot water beat some of the aches out of her. After she dressed in a fresh change of clothes, she took from her wallet the Melinda June Garlock driver's license and replaced it with the one in the name of Elizabeth Bennett. She packed away the auburn wig and fake eyeglasses. She put on the chopped every which way jet black Vogue version punky number, the fake nose ring, silver serpent with one ruby eye, blue eyeshadow and matching lipstick. "Hello, Liz Bennett." After tossing the room key onto the bed, she left the motel without sleeping there. An hour later, in Casa Grande, at a Best Western Suites, Liz Bennett submitted her driver's license to the desk clerk as ID and paid cash for a little suite with a king-size bed. Chapter 14. The courtyard by Marriott was near Indianapolis International Airport, and there were several other hotels in the general area. Jolie didn't want to go into any of them, because maybe her mother and sister, and who knew what others like them they were able to summon, might soon be searching for her in those establishments. However, there wasn't anywhere else she could just walk into as though she belonged there, so she chose the largest hotel, a six-story place maybe a mile from the Marriott. She sat in a comfortable chair in the lobby, not in a direct line from the front entrance, but with a good view of it, prepared to flee if she saw a beloved face with a terrifying new aspect. She had the disposable phone. With an indelible ink felt-tip pen, Mother had written the number of Daddy's disposable on this one, in case she forgot it. As Jolie tried to think what to say to her father, strove to find words that might convince him the crazy-sounding accusation she made was the truth, she held the phone tightly in both hands. This wasn't just a burner cell. This was her one precious link to a sane past, to what was left of her family, to whatever hope she dared to entertain. In this city, where she'd never been before, she was alone, without a dime, without ID. She'd left her purse in the room at the Marriott. They had parked Aunt Tandy's Dodge at the Marriott, but she didn't have a key for it. Anyway, she didn't dare go back there in case her mother or the hotel had called the police. She had run through the lobby like a crazy person, threatening to bite people, so the police would probably want to put her in the hospital for observation. In the hospital, they would most likely sedate her. If she was sedated, she would be helpless. When she woke, Mother and Twyla would be there, and she wouldn't know whether or not they had injected her while she'd been sleeping. No. Wrong. She would know, on some level, but it would be too late. She would not be able to save herself. She would thereafter be calling somebody the way Twyla had called somebody, and she would be doing every hateful thing that he told her to do. The object clutched in her hands wasn't merely a phone, but also a talisman with the magical power to deliver her out of this present darkness and into the light once more. If she could just get her act together and think what to say to Daddy. Sandwiched between her hands, the phone rang. She gasped and twitched in her chair and nearly cried out in surprise. She fumbled with the phone and took the call on the third ring. Daddy? As she spoke, she realized that her mother might remember this number, that this could be Mother or Twyla. Maybe, somehow, the moment she accepted the call, they knew where she was. A magical talisman might work both ways. But it was Daddy.
Jolie, is that you, girl?
The phone would expire. The line would go dead. Something rotten would surely happen before she put the right words together and managed to speak them. But nothing rotten happened. And after only a brief hesitation, Jolie said, Daddy, why did Cora Gunderson do such a horrible thing? Did someone inject her with a drug or something? Did someone tell her to do it? Daddy hesitated, too. And Jolie thought the line had gone dead after all, but then he said,
What's wrong, Candy Girl? Where did you get that idea?
People were coming and going from the lobby. Bellmen with luggage carts, guests. But no one took special notice of Jolie Tillman. No one sat in other nearby lobby chairs. The words spilled out in an undisciplined torrent. Somebody injected Twyla. I don't know who or why, but she had these syringes and ampules. Twyla did, had them in her suitcase, and she injected Mother while I was sleeping, sedated her and injected her, and just now they both tried to inject me, so I had to bite Mommy and hit her really hard. Jolie began to cry. Daddy, it was so awful. I had to bite her. She was Mommy, and she wasn't, and I bit her. It was the worst thing ever. She had lost it. Blown the chance to convince him, ranted like a child. Daddy said,
Oh, God.
And she knew he thought she'd lost her mind. He said,
Oh, God.
Again, in the most awful way. And she said, It's true, Daddy. It sounds crazy, but it's really true. Please believe me. His voice broke. He was choking with emotion.
Jolie. Oh, God. I believe you.
And though he kept speaking, he began to cry. He who never cried easily, if at all. And it was then that Jolie knew beyond all last doubts that her life had changed profoundly and forever. Chapter 15. Daddy had said that someone was already here in Indianapolis to meet them, had just started out for the Marriott, and he had to call at once and send that person to Jolie instead. Then he realized that when Mother woke this morning and was changed, she might have given his phone number to the Arcadians, whoever they were. He didn't know if they had the capability to find him by his burner phone once they knew the number, but he could not take a chance. Would destroy it as soon as he had hung up and had used another phone to call the person en route. He also didn't know if, with the burner number, the wrong people might be listening this very minute. He didn't think they could be, but he didn't want to name the person who was coming for Jolie or give her a description. He said only that the right person, the person he was sending, would know Jolie because Jolie was 17, beautiful, about 5'6", and black. And Jolie would know the person who came to her could be trusted if that person told her something that only she and Daddy knew. Their rapid-fire conversation ended, and Daddy was gone before Jolie quite realized that the phone in her hand could no longer reach him, for he was switching off and would soon smash his own disposable cell. She was even more isolated than she had been just 2 minutes earlier. Now there was no one she could call, not her grandmother, not Aunt Tandy and Madison, because maybe they had become like Mother and Twyla. Jolie couldn't be sure that she could trust them. The next 5 minutes were 5 eternities, and she tensed as each new arrival came through the front entrance of the hotel. She liked to read all kinds of books, and she read her share of spy novels, but she was no good at this cloak-and-dagger stuff, too edgy for it. The right person, the contact, turned out to be the last one Jolie would have expected. A blonde in a white blouse and a black denim jacket and black jeans. Hard to tell her age. Maybe 40, maybe 50. Her black boots featured elaborately carved leather with bright blue inlays, and she wore dangly diamond earrings even in the middle of the day. She walked directly to Jolie, who stood up as she approached, and in what might have been a Texas accent, she said, "Darling, when you were the littlest girl, your daddy made up funny stories just for your own self and no one else. Stories about a mouse sheriff named of Whiskers." Jolie liked the woman on sight and might have trusted her a little even if she hadn't known about Whiskers, the mouse sheriff. "How are you doing, child?"
"I'm a mess. Scared, sad, sick in my heart. But hanging on."
"Me and you, we'll hang on together," the woman said. "I'm Nadine Sackett. Your daddy's at our place in Texas. We're taking you to him. But plans changed all sudden-like, so now we're going there roundabout. When we're in the taxi, we don't use names, and nothing we talk about will be what's really happening with us. You get me, darling?"
"Yes, I understand."
Nadine had arrived in a taxi, but she didn't want to depart here in one. They left by a side entrance. Never using the sidewalk along the street, they crossed from the grounds of this hotel to the parking lot of a neighboring hotel. At the new place, Nadine hailed a cab, which they took downtown to the convention center. From there, they walked to the Westin Indianapolis, the largest and fanciest hotel that Jolie had ever seen. Although Nadine wasn't a guest, she somehow engaged the concierge to help her book a rental car, and it wasn't half an hour before they were on the road in a Cadillac Escalade.
"We were going to scoot you all, you, your mom, and your sister, right over to the airport here and then out, but when this ugliness raised itself up, that couldn't work anymore. Maybe the bad hats aren't crawling all over the terminals by now, but later they'll be looking through all the video there, trying to find where you went and who with. So you and me, we'll drive to St. Louis, about 4.5 hours without a tailwind. By then, Leland and Kelsey will be waiting there with the jet, and we'll slip right down the sky to home."
On top of everything else that had happened this day, the speed and confidence with which Nadine took the current situation in hand both reassured Jolie and left her a little disoriented.
"Who are Leland and Kelsey?"
"Leland's the rascal wedded me when I was but 19. Kelsey Bodine was sent to us down to the ranch when she was 14, as dour as a mortician with constipation when we first met him. That boy didn't know a mule from a horse from a pony back in those days. Thought himself slow-witted, which was the worst of the lies the world had told him. He's 23 now, works with us and co-pilots with Leland every time Leland goes up. You'll probably like old Kelsey. I know he'll like you, considering there's not a boy with eyes and a heart who wouldn't."
"You have your own jet?"
"Now, darling, don't you go expecting a big 747 tricked up like some palace in the sky. It's just a little old Learjet, hauls about a dozen. But it's a darn cozy way to get around."
For Jolie, that trip to St. Louis was like a drive from a graveyard after a funeral, marked by sorrow and anguish and worry about the future, but it was also just the littlest bit as engaging as Harry Potter's first trip from Platform 9 3/4 in King's Cross Station to Hogwarts School. Nadine was a talker. She talked about herself and Leland, about the Sackett home and school, as well as about a dazzling variety of other things. And she got Jolie to talk about herself, more than she had talked about herself in ages. Yet by the time they arrived at the private craft terminal at St. Louis International and boarded the Lear and were airborne, Jolie couldn't remember more than a fraction of what either of them had said. When her life was in the hands of Mr. Sackett and Kelsey Bodine, a crushing weariness overcame Jolie. Not having slept well the past 2 nights, she thought she would never sleep well again, considering what could happen to you in your sleep. However, she fell sound asleep as they slid down the sky to Texas. Chapter 16. In Casa Grande, a town of 50,000 souls, Jane found a restaurant with a good wine list. She drank 2 glasses of Cabernet Sauvignon and 8 filet mignon. She was confident in her Elizabeth Bennet look, and she felt safe. The 3-star Motor Inn offered cable TV, in which she had no interest, and Sirius Radio. She tuned to a classical music channel. The pianist Glenn Gould. Bach's Goldberg Variations. She mixed a vodka and Coke and sat in an armchair with 3 objects at hand. The cameo Travis had given her for good luck. The wedding band she could no longer wear in public. The wallet-sized photograph of Miriam Rigowitz, whom Bernie had lost a year earlier. Gould's brilliant music spoke of both joy and suffering, approaching the heart through the mind, braiding a listener's intellect and emotions until those aspects of human experience, often at odds, were united and healed. As the music transported Jane, she was captivated by the photo of Miriam, reading that clear and gentle face as if it were a novel, imagining stories in it that she could never know were true. Her fascination puzzled her, until she understood that it was the Miriams of the world for whom she lived now, for whom she might die. People who lived full lives with little interest in fame or the ideologies that enfrenzied the self-described elites. Over the centuries, the Miriams and the Bernies and the millions like them were the fonts of free and civil societies, which was why the likes of DJ Michael so despised them and yearned to oppress them. Freedom and civility were barriers to absolute power and to the adoration that the powerful could command of others. She did not want another vodka. She undressed, went to bed, turned out the lamp. With her pistol under the pillow on which her husband would never rest his head, she lay in the dark and in the thrall of music. Maybe she was a woman born in the wrong era, for whom some period of the past had been intended, a woman out of time in more than one sense. In sleep, time did not exist to harry her. There was no hour of reckoning to dread. For once, no child in peril. Chapter 17. Saturday, Jane went to the library in Casa Grande and used a computer to research recent references to DJ Michael. Evidently, in the interest of his personal security, it had been announced only the previous day that he would attend a charity gala the following Saturday in San Francisco to receive a humanitarian award. She suspected his appearance at the gala was bait meant to draw her to that venue to scope it out for a possible assault on him. She would be sure not to venture within sight of the place. She spent only a few minutes in the library and from there drove 3 hours to Yuma, Arizona, where she stayed the night. At 11 o'clock Sunday morning, she arrived in San Diego and used a burner phone to call the number Otis Faucheur had given her. When a man answered, Jane did not identify herself. "I believe you've been expecting me to call since Wednesday."
"When would you like to meet?"
"At your earliest convenience."
2 o'clock.
He gave her an address in La Jolla. One of the toniest neighborhoods of San Diego, La Jolla was a graceful community of tree-lined streets and interesting shops. At the upper end, residences there could cost 8 figures. Wilson Faucheur's house was worth a mid-7-figure price, perhaps 5,000 square feet of soft contemporary architecture. It stood on a terraced hill, not part of the ultra-expensive front row, but on the 3rd street from the ocean. When she drove by, she saw nothing suspicious. She parked the Explorer Sport on a parallel street and walked back to the house. Although Otis Faucheur had made it clear that he would have her killed if she ever returned to his compound in that Arkansas hollow, she had little concern that she would be at risk in his son's house. By Otis's way of thinking, she and he were exploiters of weaknesses in the system, allies to a degree, though she must remember that he was part of the ruling class because he bribed politicians, while she was a true outsider. In a crunch, he would deem her expendable. She rang the bell, and the man who answered was quite different from his father. tall, rangy, with thick dark hair. His features were too sharp to be handsome, but he was attractive, about 40. Closing the door behind her, he said,
"My wife wants no part of this. She's out till 5 o'clock. You have to be gone before then."
"Understood."
"My dad told me who you are. If you hadn't cleared my brother Dozier on that case, there's no way in hell I'd do this."
"I don't blame you."
"Even so, you're such poison now. I wonder if Dad is losing it, getting sentimental in his old age."
"I assure you, he's about as sentimental as a sledgehammer." The man's features grew sharper, like a totem pole visage shaped by a hatchet.
"Is that supposed to be funny?"
"What it's supposed to be is an accurate assessment. Look, the less we spar with each other, the quicker I'll be gone."
"That's something, anyway."
He led her through the house, predominantly white with soft gray accents, sleek modern furniture, and abstract art as soulless as chains of binary code laid down on paper by a computer. His spacious home office was on the lowest of 3 floors. Beyond the floor-to-ceiling windows, the homes on the lower 2 streets shelved to the ocean, which appeared to have been marshaled with the sky to complement the decor of this house. Under medium gray heavens, dark gray water checkered with low white caps. The walls were hung with framed renderings of some of Wilson Faucheur's projects. He didn't build one home at a time, but 20-story condominiums, office towers, hotels, and government buildings. He favored architects who added flair in layers over what were, in essence, designs reminiscent of Soviet-era apartment blocks. 2 long tables, each held a computer, printer, scanner, books, and multiple ring binders. Between them, a 5-foot-wide work run allowed Faucheur to swivel his office chair away from either table and roll to the other in one swift motion. He provided a second chair for Jane, and they sat before a computer.
"So, there's a building. You want to know the guts of it."
"Can you spoof this? Cover your tracks?" His icy stare made his words superfluous.
"What am I getting into?"
"Nothing serious, if you're good at misdirection." After a silence, during which he might have considered denying his father's request, he said,
"I can ricochet through a couple offshore addresses. If necessary, later, they can be folded up as though they never existed."
"Wouldn't be a bad idea," Jane said. She gave him the location of the 10-story building that would be the end of her quest, and possibly the end of her. When Faucheur had established his roundabout approach, he started with Google Street View. The target structure had a modern feel. Soft rounded corners, pale limestone, stainless steel doors and window frames, and decorative elements. Over the front entrance, in brushed steel letters, were the words, "Far Horizons." The top 3 floors were recessed about 15 feet from the lower floors to allow wraparound balconies. The building stood at the apex of its street, in an area where most structures were 6 stories or lower, so the top 3 floors would have stunning views.
"It's in an eclectic neighborhood, but just the same, it's an unusual mixed-use building," Faucheur said. "The 3 uppermost floors are obviously residential, but if that's a company name at the entrance, then the lower 7 are business offices, and each of the wraparound balconies seems to flow without interruption, so all the apartments at each level share 1 continuous view deck, which is seriously bad design."
Jane said, "Only 1 apartment on the 9th floor. None on the 8th or 10th. Those floors are security barriers for the 9th. That wintry stare again. This time, he didn't bother with words. If Jane didn't tell him, he'd research the building's history after she left. "The name David James Michael mean anything to you?"
"Damn."
"The 9th floor is where he lives when he's in San Francisco."
"And you want to find a way past his security?"
"I'm not going past it. I'm going through it."
"To do what?"
Video his confession to a series of capital crimes that will blow up his empire and get him the death penalty. Faucheur swiveled toward the big windows and stared at the sea, as if hoping that the captain of the Ship of Wisdom would semaphore advice to him. Jane said, "I already have most of what I need. There are just a few things I have to learn."
"Michael is a big environmentalist. I guess you know that."
"I hear he cares."
"Yeah, he cares. He cares about DJ Michael."
"Gives a lot of money."
"And gets back more. The son of a bitch uses his eco-movement friends to sabotage the projects of his competitors in the permit stage. A few years go by, another company builds something almost the same as what was rejected, and through one back door or another, he has a piece of it, if not all of it."
"You're one of the ones he screwed over, huh?" Faucheur turned away from the sea and met her eyes.
"What do you need to know?"
"Four elevators," she said, repeating what Randall Larkin had told her. "Three go no higher than the seventh floor. The fourth serves floors 8 through 10, nothing below."
"You need a special key to unlock it?"
"Yeah, and once in the car," she said, "you have to submit to a retinal scan and be matched to those on an approved list. If you're trying to fake it, the car locks down and holds you for the police."
"So the elevators are no good for you."
"Then there are two stairs, one at each end of the building." He nodded.
"According to fire code."
"But they only go to the seventh floor."
"That would never pass the building department," Faucheur said. "Not even for DJ Michael."
"I've been told there's a hidden staircase. Would the building code allow that?"
"If it was a legit part of an architectural security system. You've got your electronic system, and sometimes, for very high-end units, you also have your architectural system."
"You mean like a panic room?"
"Panic room, yeah, and sometimes a secret escape route from the building, maybe into the basement. Or even vertical, then horizontal, into the basement of the building next door and out from there."
"Would a panic room or hidden stairwell be in the plans filed with the city?"
"No."
He turned his attention to the Google Street View on the monitor, his expression less severe. He seemed to be in the grip of a kind of boyish enthusiasm.
"But usually they require you to walk the police through it after construction, so the cops will know your hidden back door in a hostage situation. A lot of the time, though, there's no compliance."
"The guy who told me all the rest, he knew there's a hidden stairwell, but he didn't know where. Can you find it?" He pressed the fingertips of his right hand to the street view on the screen, as if he could solve the puzzle by a psychic touch.
"Every building has voids, awkward spaces that don't have any use in the general floor plan. They get walled off. You don't even know they exist. They're usually small, and they're never contiguous through an entire structure. If you know how to read blueprints and you can identify a void running top to bottom or end to end, that'll be the hidden stairs or the hidden passage."
"Can you access the blueprints in the city building department? I assume they require the builder to file electronic plans." He shook his head.
"If possible, that's not how you want to do it. The city databases, their whole system, it's government garbage. It'll bog us down, make us crazy. There's another way."
"Then you'll get me what I need?" He sat back in his chair and spun once in a full circle and smiled at her.
"If yesterday anyone told me I'd have a chance to help bring down DJ Michael, I'd have given my left nut for the opportunity."
"That won't be necessary," Jane said. Chapter 18. Wilson called his wife and told her not to come home until 6 o'clock. He and Jane were going to need more than the 3 hours that he had allotted. There was a coffee maker in his home office, and Jane brewed a strong pot. They both took it, black and sugarless. Wilson produced a plate of his wife's chocolate-drop lemon cookies. Jane wasn't a cookie person, but this seemed like a cookie moment if ever there was one, and they were delicious. Rather than hack the San Francisco Building Department's archives, Wilson went to a website called Emporis, which styled itself as a provider of construction data on buildings of high public and economic value. From there, he was directed to the company that had put up the building in question, and to all the principal subcontractors that the primary contractor had employed.
DJ hired the best, Wilson said, and it's not a company he's got a piece of, as far as I know.
The contractor maintained electronic archives, and Wilson was confident of getting into them in mere minutes, because he had spent hours hacking them in the past, and had used a Trojan to set up a back door to allow easy access in the future.
I've bid against them, he told Jane. They shave costs in ways that kill their competitors. I needed to know how.
He seemed to read her expression, and smiled ruefully.
Yeah, I guess I didn't fall as far from the tree of Otis as I sometimes like to think.
Beyond the wall of glass, the loom of the sky gradually wove darker skeins into the overcast as the planet turned away from the sun and the sea darkled with a reflection of the clouds. The building has 3 stories of underground parking. Of the above-ground floors, the first 7 encompass 112,000 square feet of office space. Because of the wraparound balcony, the 3 upper floors total a little more than 27,000. After much scanning and study of blueprints, Wilson found a contiguous series of voids, 6 or 7 feet square, dead center on the south wall, running all the way from the roof to the first of 3 levels of subterranean parking.
It might be a spiral staircase, he said, although it's just large enough for a switchback with small landings.
How is it accessed?
It appears to terminate behind a supply closet of some kind. My best guess is the closet will be lined with storage shelves, and a hidden lever will swing one set of shelves out of the way.
Secret door.
Totally Indiana Jones, he said.
There'll be an alarm on the door. Any way I could foil it?
If the door's properly hidden, you wouldn't want an alarm on it. An alarm ties your architectural security to your electronic security, so if a really brilliant black hat hacker gets in the latter, he can also find the former. Then your secret escape route isn't secret anymore.
Cameras in there?
If you can monitor the hidden stairwell through security cameras, a black hat guy can monitor it too, and see where you are in the middle of your escape. A bolt hole or a secret passageway is far more likely to remain secret if it's kept simple. You design it so it can't be found, at least not casually. So then, the only one who's ever going to use it is the guy who feels he needs it in the first place.
With dusk, a brisk breeze came off the water and up the hill, and palm fronds tossed as if the trees lamented the passing of the light. What I believe, Jane said. What I've been told is that I can get into either the 8th or the 10th floor from those stairs, but not into the 9th. The door at the 9th would have to be blown down with a packet of C4, kind of difficult to arrive stealthily after that.
DJ Michael lives on the 9th, huh? You said the 8th and 10th are security barriers. What does that mean, exactly?
You don't want to know. I intend to go in at the 8th floor. If I make it through there alive, I need a way to get up to the 9th from the 8th, some way he won't be expecting. Wilson regarded her in silence for a long moment.
Everything about you on the news is bullshit, isn't it?
Most of it. I have had to kill some people in self-defense. On the news, they never call it self-defense.
What the hell is all this really about?
He held up one hand to silence himself.
Yeah, okay. I don't want to know.
He swung back to the screen.
Let's see if we can find you what you need.
Chapter 19. By Monday afternoon, Jane had acquired two new pistols from John and Judy White, who used the names Pete and Lois Jones, the Syrian refugees who had likely never seen Syria, who lived in the Reseda house with the many lawn gnomes, proud grandparents of non-existent grandchildren. The guns were polymer frame Heckler & Koch 45 compacts, carrying 9-round magazines with semi-staggered ammo stacks that allowed for a comfortable grip. They were fitted with sound suppressors. She also acquired spare magazines, boxes of ammunition, and a new double-carry shoulder rig, featuring holsters with swivel connectors and a suede harness. Although it was possible to overarm and lose freedom of movement, she also purchased a Gould and Goodrich gun belt with a Velcro attachment system for securing various items, as well as a few toys to hang from it. Instead of a too small pink sweatsuit, the Zoftig Lois wore a too small purple number, yellow instead of green fingernail polish. The 6 rings with huge diamonds had given birth to a 7th. Before she left, standing on the threshold, Jane couldn't resist saying, "Bernie Rigowitz of Elegant Weave said you sell first-class wigs."
"Russian hair,"
Lois said between drags on her cigarette. "Is that right?"
"Is best hair in world."
"I didn't know that."
"Except don't use Chernobyl hair."
"Because of the accident at the nuclear power plant?" Lois issued a plume of smoke. She pinched a fleck of something from her tongue and examined it as she said,
"Was no accident. Was not just power plant."
The woman's knowing demeanor suggested that she was not merely repeating a tabloid newspaper fantasy. If not just a power plant and not an accident, then what? The black eyes narrowed, and in them glimmered the suggestion of a soul so hard and cold that a garish sweatsuit and flamboyant nail polish and an excess of rings could no longer lend her even a slightly comic air.
"Chernobyl nothing to you. Go. Go where you go. You want to die? So go die."
She closed the door in Jane's face. Chapter 20. Monday night, 10 o'clock. Jane settled in a motel in Greater San Francisco, in a district that hadn't been seedy just 10 years earlier, but that now lay in decline. Clutching bags and bundles of possessions with mostly imaginary value, the multitudes of homeless, the alcoholics and the addicts and the mentally deranged, as well as those who were just the sane and sober poor, caulked the darkened doorways of shuttered stores, the cracks and crevices of shrubbery in a nearby pocket park, the concavities between dumpsters in the alleyways. Sirens swelled and faded in the festering night, as did shrill laughter. Someone drunkenly sang the old Jim Croce song, "Time in a Bottle," and suddenly stopped, as if silenced by a blow. Having decided to lie down fully dressed, near 11 o'clock, Jane was brought off the bed by the crying of a child. It was a low, persistent sound, not petulant bawling, but an expression of misery and settled sorrow that some adult should have, in time, soothed away with words and a loving touch. But the weeping did not cease. At first, she thought the sound came from a room adjacent to hers. When she listened at the shared walls both to the west and east, that didn't seem to be the case. She paced, increasingly restless, until at last she shrugged into the single-holster shoulder rig, then into a sport coat. With the Colt concealed, she left her room and stood on the cracked and stained concrete walk that served the long wing of shabby rooms that were like a cell block for those who had never been convicted of their crimes and chose to self-imprison. She walked the motel, end to end, and the wretched complaint of the child always rose elsewhere. Her attention focused on an old VW bus in a corner of the parking lot, its windows curtained. When she approached it, however, the child's crying did not originate there. The weeping stopped. She waited for it to resume. No human sounds, only mechanical noises near and far, as though the era of humanity had passed, leaving a city in which all the citizens were machines. The child remained silent. She returned to her room. She took off the coat and the shoulder rig. Travis. She wondered if in extreme circumstances a mother could hear her child crying hundreds of miles away.